Very Bad Wizards is a podcast with a philosopher, my dad, and a psychologist, Dave Pizarro, having an informal discussion about issues in science and ethics. Please note that the discussion contains bad words that I'm not allowed to say, and knowing my dad, some very inappropriate jokes.
She said, pardon me, sir, while I go into the kitchen and fuck the chicken. He looked around at his buddy and said, shit, if this gonna be that kind of party, I'm gonna stick my dick in the mashed potato.
Welcome to Very Bad Wizards. I'm David Pizarro from Cornell University. Tamler, in the movie we're going to discuss, there's this great quote. I mean, I think it's the quote of the movie, where they're discussing a publisher who only prints philosophy books. And the philosophy books are described as having small print, big words, and no sales. So I know you're working on a new book. Is this what we can expect?
No, I think it's going to have at least medium-sized print.
Big print for your demographic. It's like the older listeners. Can you pick the font?
Yeah, one of those for old people. You know,
the people who listen to you.
Then it can be shorter.
Like when you turn in a paper in junior high and you really need to cover the page limit, and you just make the font a little bigger and put
It's not just junior high. That also happens in college. I have to, like, instruct my students that I'm not an idiot.
So, yeah, that quote was from a movie because this is a movie episode, surprisingly. I picked the movie. And unsurprisingly, because he's been with us for every movie episode, we have Yoel Imbar from the University of Toronto.
Hey, guys. Welcome. Thanks for having me. Do you remember how I became the movie person? It wasn't on the basis of expertise, because I don't really know anything about movies.
I feel like maybe I brought you along as
moral support.
But I
think,
like,
it was just that you were, it's not like we had the idea of doing a series of movie episodes all featuring Yoel. That, like, we did Unforgiven. And having just listened to it again, because I was teaching it in a class, like, it was good. It was a good episode, and you were good, and it was like, but it's still a trial. If this one sucks, then you're out.
Right. It's always provisional.
Don't get too comfortable.
We'll try and keep up the streak.
I mean, if anybody can go through that other horrible movie with us, I think that you've at least earned a couple of buys, like where you have to...
Are you talking about Straw Dogs or which...
I've suppressed the name.
That's a great movie, and it's still probably one of the big disappointments in my life that you continue not to appreciate it. Yeah, so today we're doing a movie, Rope, that David actually... This is the first time that David has suggested a movie, and we agreed. Before we get to why David wanted to do this movie, we want to thank you all very much for your support. In particular, all of you, and there were many of you, there were hundreds of you that bought t-shirts. We really appreciate that. I hope you enjoy the t-shirts. They should be coming about when this releases. You should start to expect to be getting your t-shirt. You can still, if like 20 more people or something order t-shirts, right, they'll start sending them out again. So it's not technically over, but it's over that you'll be guaranteed, I guess, a t-shirt.
Right. It works like a Kickstarter campaign. It was funded. The buying period closed. But if they get enough demand, I think as of recording, if 20 more people say they want a t-shirt, they'll print another run.
Right.
And so
those of you, could I go to the website right now and order a t-shirt or no?
You could. Teespring.com, teespring.com/verybadwizards. And we also have a link on our webpage, verybadwizards.com. And you could try to order a t-shirt.
If you just want to get, like,
it would have to,
but you would, right. You wouldn't obviously get charged if they don't.
No.
Right. Or you can wait till our next t-shirt drive, which we'll probably do, I don't know, like 6 months, 9 months.
Which will be a pink version, because Tamler said he wanted one for the ladies.
Well, my daughter.
And it had to be pink.
My daughter sent a long email to us about that, if you'll recall. Maybe we'll read that on another. So you can support us by going to our support page, clicking on the Amazon link, and you can also donate directly via PayPal. We really appreciate both. And then like us on Facebook. You can tweet us at Pease, at Tamler, at Very Bad Wizards. And rate us on iTunes. And you can email us at verybadwizards@gmail.com. We've been getting a lot of emails, and I swear to God, people have been doubting us, but we really do read all of them. And Dave, we just got a great one. We responded to some. Yeah, yeah.
We got a great one just last night that I wanted to read. And by the way, since we're tweeting, Yoel, you're at Y-O-R-L.
Yep. At URL.
On Twitter. So if he says anything that you find offensive or brilliant,
please get in touch.
Are you live tweeting this episode, Yoel?
I am.
It's like just gets in a bunch of unfollows.
I'm also streaming it on Periscope. Only my
That's just one source of audio.
Yeah, that's right. So it's just me talking to my computer.
Tamler looks confused about what we're talking about.
But, is that like MySpace?
Like my
it's exactly like MySpace. Maybe we don't want to get into this right now.
So we got this wonderful email from Anne Lalonde, who is a attorney, and she works on trademarks. And she just happened to listen to one of our episodes, the episode on slurs and offensiveness. And she wrote in to tell us about some sort of interesting features of trademark and patent law. And it turns out that the United States prohibits people from registering trademarks that consist of immoral, deceptive, or scandalous matter, or trademarks that, quote, may disparage persons, living or dead, institutions, beliefs, or national symbols, or bring them into contempt or disrepute. You might imagine that it's hard to determine what fits into that. She gave us a list of trademarks that have been found scandalous and that have not been found scandalous. It's just a very entertaining list.
Let's play a game. Yoel, don't look, and I'm going to read a couple, and you tell me whether you think it's banned or not banned.
Found to be scandalous or immoral or not.
Okay.
Yeah. Twatty girl.
Clearly scandalous or immoral.
You're 0 for 1. No. That was trademark. Found to be scandalous.
Really? For you, it's a cartoon strip. So,
yeah. Okay, next.
Cumbrella.
Yeah. Cumbrella?
Cumbrella.
No, clearly scandalous or immoral.
Wrong.
It's a condom brand, and no.
It's not scandalous or immoral. Madonna.
Just Madonna?
Yeah.
I would allow that.
No, that was deemed scandalous.
Well, I'm like anti-correlated.
Yeah, I haven't gotten a single one right.
Exactly.
The bearded clam.
what's the
name of the bar?
It's a restaurant.
All right, I would deny that.
You finally got one right. That
about time.
Isn't that the name of the bar in Family Guy?
Is it? I don't know.
I think so. So this just, I think, goes to show that the law is not intuitive.
Okay, last one.
You come like a girl. Clothing.
Clothing. I not allowed. Not allowed.
Yeah, good. Yeah, that was kind of easy.
Okay.
I just want to know who thought that would be okay.
I wish. Right? Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. So thank you very much, Ms. Lalonde. That was a great, great email. And she was actually a philosophy major, so hence her interest in porn. Clearly, if you were to listen to us as a philosophy podcast that we are, you would rightfully conclude that all philosophers must be deeply interested in porn.
So, yeah, sorry. Are you done with that thought?
I wanted to fade out, slow fade on that.
So let's talk about rope. And why don't we start, since this was your idea, not to throw you under the bus, why did yeah. you want to do it?
Wait, did we already say what the movie was?
So he sort of swallowed it.
Yeah,
Rope,
a little bit.
We picked Rope by Alfred Hitchcock, 1948. It's a movie based on a play. Every once in a while, I get on a kick. We've talked about the film noir kick that Tamler inspired in me. There were movies that I just hadn't seen. The other thing is, I tend to not like movies based on plays. I mean, maybe Glengarry Glen Ross is a huge exception, but even that, the pacing of I often just don't think it translates well. So much of what I like about Hitchcock is you think about North by Northwest, these crop duster scene, for instance, the way that he creates suspense, it feels to me is just really cinema and not stage. And I think that he was trying, and I think he successfully to create that suspense in this movie. But really the real reason is I think it offered a good fodder to discuss what I think is an interesting case. It maybe one of the only cases in which somebody's purported philosophy actually led them to action, where you actually have a philosophy that is espoused by someone that causes them to commit a behavior.
Yeah, so let's give a little background. Even if you haven't seen the movie, you're probably familiar with the Leopold and Loeb case. This movie is based on a real event that happened in 1924. The Leopold and Loeb, they murdered a young schoolmate and they were caught and they were tried. And at the trial, it came out that they had been inspired by their reading of Nietzsche's philosophy.
Yeah, well, you hadn't seen it.
No, and right. I also like Hitchcock. And I thought of it as kind of like, you know, if somebody asks you what your favorite Hitchcock movie is and you say Vertigo, that's sort of obvious. But if you're like a real hipster, then you say Rope. So it's sort of...
Yeah, that's right.
Because they are kind of hipsters.
Yeah, they are. They're totally proto-hipsters. do we want to get into what actually happens in the film?
So the movie starts out... after an establishing shot and the Hitchcock cameo, the movie just starts out, two men are choking another younger man, and then they put him in this trunk to store him after they've killed him. Right from the get-go, you can see that one of them, a character named Brandon, is very kind of excited by what they're doing. He's clearly the ringleader, at least in the movie. And again, I think this is modeled to some extent on Leopold. The ideology of the murder, the impetus for the murder seems to come from him with the other boy played by Farley Granger, right?
Philip.
Yeah. It sort of comes out that they're doing this to show their superiority to conventional morality. The laws and norms, like don't kill people, those are only there for the common person, not for the privileged few. And they take this as an understanding of Nietzsche's idea of the Übermensch, but it's clear that they were inspired by who will later be Jimmy Stewart, an old instructor of theirs at prep school, who taught the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche.
There is something that we didn't say, which is one of the reasons that this movie is so well known is the style in which it's shot, which is appears to be one continuous take. I don't know if he was... I mean, there had been other long takes, but I don't know if anybody had attempted to make an entire movie look like one long take.
You know what? I don't think so. It hasn't been done that much since. Birdman was shot to look that way. And actually, although I think some people dismiss it as a gimmick, having seen it, I don't know, about 15 years ago and just watched it again last night, I found that it was really effective.
I think, you know, the constraint was that you could only fit 10 minutes of film in a camera. He had to find creative ways around this constraint. And so what he did was, rather than use traditional edits, he would zoom into, say, the back of a character. So they murder, the opening shot is they're murdering a guy, which is, I think, one of the things I want to say was that it's interesting in that this is not tension building up to a murder. The murder is the first scene, and it's very, very close shot. It's almost intimate. the three guys and the one in the middle with the rope around his neck, and they decide in celebration they have a party. And in the party they invite the family of the murdered kid. They invite his parents. His father shows up. They invite their old schoolmaster who espoused this philosophy. They invite the murdered kid's girlfriend, the girlfriend's ex-boyfriend.
And this is all Brandon. This is all Brandon setting this up. Philip clearly had no knowledge of that the old schoolmaster, Jimmy Stewart's coming, and no real interest in exposing themselves in this way just to make it seem more like a work of art.
It is. It's the work of art, and he's throwing it in the face of everybody.
Yeah, so he also invites the murderee. David is supposed to be there.
That's right.
So everybody's waiting. Like, well, where's David? It's not like him to be late. I'm getting a little worried about him. I wonder whether he's all right. It is kind of brilliantly sadistic.
And so this gets to one of the key plot points that you already mentioned, Tamler. They put the murdered kid in a trunk. So one of those old just storage trunks that's in the living room. They essentially put it on display. And so they even make the main table, rather than being the dining room table, they put a tablecloth over the trunk, and they set that as the centerpiece where the food is served. And that trunk is in many of the shots in the foreground.
And often this is what the single take. Often the camera will be focused on the trunk, and the characters will be having conversations, but they'll be off camera.
Yoel, you pointed out when we were talking before how you know, there's this enormous tension because you don't want the body to be found. Uh-huh. But unlike other movies, you don't find yourself rooting for the killers, but you nonetheless, like, it's, you know.
Right. I find myself having to remind myself that these are bad guys. They, you know, their crime should be discovered. And obviously the whole movie, they're going to be found out. You know what's going to happen in a way. Nonetheless, there's these incredibly tense moments, like where the housekeeper actually starts to open the trunk in order to put something in there. Brandon stops her, right? He's like, no, you can do that later.
And it's interesting because they're not likable. They're not sympathetic. So I wonder what it is, therefore, that makes you still not want the body to be discovered. Is it like the discomfort of it?
Yeah, I think that what's happening, at least if I try to introspect to the extent that that's successful, is that I am trying to protect the other characters from finding the body, because I think that I have some sense that it would be disastrous for whoever comes upon the body. Like if the maid found it, then they would have to probably kill her. So maybe that's why.
Maybe.
Hitchcock does build, it's a huge investment in building this tension. And one of the early scenes that shows the difference between Brandon, the ringleader, and Philip, who I guess, and we can talk about this, but I guess is not so subtly his lover.
Well, subtly in the sense that it's never referred.
It's never explicitly.
It's never explicitly.
Yeah, okay, so they don't tell it to you explicitly, but it's like two men who live in the same apartment and vacation together. It's
Yeah, they're going to go on vacation right? together. It's like
based on two people that were clearly gay and were having an affair with each other. So, yeah.
And in fact the two actors themselves were gay.
As was the screenwriter, right?
It's hiding in plain sight in 1948. And what's funny is that this was actually banned in some theaters, or you know, some theaters refused to show it because of the murder, because it's gay.
And they couldn't even talk about it on the set. I saw a documentary with the screenwriter, and it said they couldn't refer to it explicitly on the set for, I guess, legal reasons. They would just refer to their homosexuality as it.
It is the elephant in the room. It's like the other trunk. So there's this great scene that sets the stage for the different attitudes. I mean, it already opens with Brandon clearly being confident and celebratory, whereas Philip is almost immediately regrets the action. And there's this scene where you see it's in the trunk that the rope that they used to strangle the kid is actually hanging out of the trunk, right? So it's exposed. And Philip, the weaker one, let's call him, notices this, freaks out, and Brandon just sort of nonchalantly pulls it. And then there's a great scene where you see him putting it in a kitchen drawer As the door swings, you see him just kind of nonchalantly opening the door. And Brandon here is right. Brandon here is right oftentimes about how none of this matters that much, because who would think that a rope has just been used for murder? But he has like the sort of the balls to later on use that same rope to tie up a set of
for
books
the father
that
he's giving to the father of the kid
the father
that he
of
murdered.
The murdered
yeah.
kid.
I mean, in a sense, he's right. Well, let's get... I think there's an interesting scene when... I think this is a sort of key scene in the movie. All the guests have been assembled, and Jimmy Stewart, who is their old professor, playfully, he's trying to be the kind of the witty, sophisticated man at the party.
Personally, I think a chicken is as good a reason for murder as a blonde, a mattress full of dollar bills, or any of the customary unimaginative reasons.
Well, now, you don't really approve of murder, Rupert, if I may.
You may, and I do. Think of the problems it would solve. Unemployment, poverty, standing in line for theater tickets.
I must say I've had a perfectly dreadful time getting tickets for that new musical.
My dear Miss Atwater, careful application of the trigger finger and a pair of seats in the first row is yours for the shooting.
Rupert, you're the end.
In the play that it was based on, the teacher was supposed to be based on Oscar Wilde. So he's just supposed to be clever and witty. All the guests are sort of appreciating that, except for the father of David. Meanwhile, Brandon, there's more of an edge to his participation in this game.
You're not serious about these theories.
Of course he is.
Oh, you're both pulling my leg.
No, why do you think that?
Well, Brandon, the notion that murder is an art which a few superior beings should be allowed to practice.
In season.
Then may I ask, who is to decide that a human being is inferior and is therefore a suitable victim for murder?
The few who are privileged to commit murder.
And just who might they be?
Oh, myself. Philip. Possibly Rupert. Well, I'm sorry, Kenneth, you're out.
Gentlemen, I'm serious.
So are we, Mr. Kentley. The few are those men of such intellectual and cultural superiority that they're above the traditional moral concepts. Good and evil, right and wrong, were invented for the ordinary average man, the inferior man, because he needs them.
Then obviously you agree with Nietzsche and his theory of the Superman.
Yes, I do.
But in any case, I'd rather not hear any more of your, forgive me, contempt for humanity and for the standards of a world that I believe is civilized.
Well, I'm sure Rupert, fortunately,
has the intelligence
and imagination.
Please, Brandon, I think we've had just about enough.
You need the schoolmaster to come and actually explicitly espouse the philosophy that influenced Brandon. And, you know, Brandon here is just drinking it. He's eating it up. He's loving this. This is exactly somebody who could appreciate what
and
they've
he's
just
still
done.
Clearly trying to impress his old teacher. I mean, you know, that's the one time he gets really nervous when Jimmy Stewart first comes over, and he's just like a kid that needs approval from like a distant father or something like that, you know?
Right.
Clearly, this is the thing that's ultimately their downfall, is he wants, like, it's not fun. It doesn't work unless somebody knows how brilliant he was. And this is the guy he wants to know.
He almost needs to be caught for someone to appreciate it.
I think he wants this person to appreciate it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the part of the movie that worked less well for me.
And it's just weird to see the guy from It's a Wonderful Life. He's talking about killing people with knives, and then he says, but there's some people who don't even deserve death by the knife. They deserve death by slow torture. And he says, bird lovers, small children, and tap dancers. It just wasn't funny the way that he said it.
It's also that maybe that may be something that just hasn't aged well. Maybe at the time those were hilarious references.
I mean, yeah.
Meanwhile, Brandon gets into the philosophy of it. He says right and wrong are just for conventional, dumb human beings. You know, there are this privileged, superior few who can rise above that, and that's what gives them the right to kill people.
Definitely consider themselves superior. And Brandon clearly considers Rupert, the schoolmaster, the James Stewart character, as one of his equals. And so, you know.
And even Rupert, Brandon says at the beginning of the movie that he's brilliant. He respects him intellectually, maybe even as his superior. But he's fastidious. He might lack the courage.
All right. These are men of will. Men of will. The whole time. This is the other source of tension. The whole time, Philip is just freaking out. He's just freaking the fuck out. It's almost like the telltale heart, right? He thinks everybody must be totally noticing Every little cue that Brandon is just so nonchalantly presenting.
And he's also drinking heavily, which doesn't help.
The whole conversation about chicken strangling just cracked me up.
Chicken strangling.
I think this was unintentional.
As I recall,
comic relief.
You're quite a good chicken strangler, aren't you?
That's a lie. I never strangled a chicken in my life.
You're quite. There's a whole conversation where they talk about having this one incident in Philip's childhood, you know, killing chickens to eat.
That's a lie. I never strangled a chicken in my life.
Them and one of them didn't quite get strangled enough.
I didn't strangle any chicken.
And he just like popped up and started.
Do you think that was a reference, or are we just reading into it now from our modern pervy perspective?
I mean,
you think that was a reference?
Reading a little bit about the
it's like choking the chicken.
Yeah, strangling the chicken. That's I need to go.
Give me 10 minutes.
I need to go strangle the chicken.
That's a lie. I never strangled a chicken in my life.
But there's a brilliant scene in the beginning that I was struggling with. You know, it seemed like it would only be a modern reference where they right after the murder, they're both very close together. He pulls out the champagne and they're
popping the
champagne.
Yeah, that was explicit. And the way, and he shot it so that it would be that.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like they're both holding like the champagne bottle kind, very close up, and it pops, and it's like a bad Austin Powers sort of, you know, train going into the tunnel.
It seems like almost a little over the top now. He said, like Austin Powers,
and you can't blame a director for in 1948 inserting references that maybe only like the people,
only the privileged few get his references. We got to take like a Strauss, Straussian reading of Hitchcock.
I just want to trademark chicken strangler.
That's a lie. I never strangled a chicken in my life.
All right, let's take a break, and come back and talk about the philosophy and psychology behind
Sounds
this
good.
Movie because I think there's a lot of interesting things. Welcome back to Very Bad Wizards. We are here with film scholar Yoel Inbar from the University of Toronto, Hitchcock expert. Are you AOS Hitchcock?
If you had read my CV, you would have seen that, actually.
Yeah, like Truffaut and Yoel Inbar. So let's talk about some of the philosophy behind this. We joked about in a couple of our episodes that when you teach ethics and you come across skeptical or nihilist views, a kid will raise their hand and say, well, if there's no objective morality, why don't I just go kill somebody? Why don't I just go on a killing spree? Why would that be the thing that you want to do now that there's no objective morality? Why not? You know, dude, do you want to go on a killing spree? Like, is that the thing that is just the thought that it's wrong, the only thing stopping you from going on a killing spree?
Right.
It is not like, it's not like recognizing that there is no objective morality will suddenly also make your actions consequence free. You might still get caught and go to jail. People are fond of saying this all the time.
But this is a movie where somebody actually seems to take that general thought and use it as a motivation to actually go and kill somebody that they have no other reason to want to kill, right? There's nothing, they have nothing against this David guy. They want to kill because they are inspired by this Übermensch philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche. None of us are Nietzsche experts, like Yoel is a Hitchcock expert, but what do you guys know of?
Almost nothing.
Very little. I mean,
I know Nazis.
To that.
That's
right.
That's the association. Yeah.
That's a very unfair association with Nietzsche. For example, Nietzsche was very not anti-Semitic and, in fact, got very angry at his sister's husband, who was a big German anti-Semite. Here's what I understand about Nietzsche. he is critical of conventional morality, and specifically the morality that is inspired by Christian principles and also the values of the Enlightenment, of Western liberalism. He criticized it, genealogy of morals. He presents a kind of debunking story for that kind of morality. And he does have this idea that this Übermensch is somebody who will create their own value system and not be restricted by the slave morality that's a legacy,
like, of Christianity.
You know, that the humble will inherit the earth.
Uh-huh.
And he thought that got in the way of true excellence. Conventional morality was an obstacle to that.
And so here's what, I mean, it does sound a little bit like, you know, you got to break some eggs to make an omelet, then. I'm not sure what part of morality you... So first of all, what it means to transcend something like morality writ large. Like, what is it that's being held back here?
Right. So there's one way to read what you just said that would seem like totally uncontroversial to us, which is that, like, there are many elements of end of the 19th century sort of bourgeois morality that now we think are totally ridiculous, right? So...
Right.
If that's the argument, then I think that many people would say, yeah, you know, right on. Like, don't let's say sexual morality of that time. We've basically decided that, like, that's not worth adhering to anymore.
Sure. And that's a good example. That's a good analogy, I think. I mean, it's certainly not the only thing that Nietzsche thought was an unfortunate legacy of Christian principles.
Right. Maybe the turn the other cheek philosophy that Malcolm X so sort of threw in Martin Luther King's face as being nothing but keeping slavery going by preventing the oppressed from truly acting, you know, in their best interest, because they just believed that they weren't allowed to.
Great example, and also I think accurate to something that Nietzsche was scornful of, is this always turn the other cheek. At the same time, he was a free will skeptic, denied. He thought it was based on a kind of incoherence that you could self-create yourself. I mean, this is what's sort of interesting about him. On the one hand, he denied this idea that we can be self-caused. But on the other hand, the kind of human being that he wanted to develop was somebody that would create themselves in a certain sense, not in maybe the logically incoherent sense, but who will not be held back by these norms that are there for historical reasons, but that may not be enabling them to achieve their true excellence.
I mean, the kindest interpretation I can make of this is that human beings ought to discover it is not a rejection of any value, but rather that you should not just simply inherit the morals of society.
That's right.
You should create them through, you know.
Did he make kind of a positive argument about the sort of morality that we should have if we're going to toss out sort of conventional or religious morality? Did he say, what should we replace it with?
To some extent, yes. But I think it's very controversial exactly what it was. It does involve I think, two elements. One is this kind of achieving a full human potential and not being held back by these inherited value system. And the other involves embracing your fate. And this is the idea of eternal recurrence, like to live a life that you would be happy to live over and over forever. In this way, it's actually, I think, that has some Buddhist or maybe Groundhog Day-like associations.
Exactly.
Like this, that if this was going to be your life, that you would be happy, you would embrace living that over and over again. That should be your sort of guiding principle.
So here's, I think, the question and the puzzle for this movie, the claims of the movie, and even maybe the claims of the people who inspired the movie, Leopold and Loeb, which is that I'm not sure that this is really the motivation for the murder. I mean, and if it really is, then I don't know what to make of these people psychologically.
Yeah, so one thing that Nietzsche's positive morality is not is you should now go and kill people. There's nothing. Not only did Nietzsche not say that, but I don't see how it follows in any way from this idea that what you need to do is murder somebody, prove your superiority through that means. At best, you know, his anti-realism about morality, his rejection of objective morality, it can say that doing that isn't objectively forbidden because nothing is. But the positive endorsement of that idea, I don't see how it follows in any way from the Nietzsche's metaethics or his whatever his positive morality is. It's not that.
Would it be fair to say that this emphasis on developing yourself, developing your own full potential, like self-actualizing, that that could make you sort of callous or indifferent to other people's needs? Like, so my primary mission in life is to be sort of the best realization of myself that I can be. And if that has bad consequences for you, well, that just sucks for you.
Except that you're a social being that has empathy for other people. And there's no reason to think that the best version of yourself wouldn't continue to have empathy for other people and that and wouldn't want to maintain social relations with other people. You could think that that's going to be what constitutes the best version of yourself, is that you recognize these parts of yourself. There's no reason to reject those parts of yourself parts of yourself.
Yeah, no, I guess. So does he talk about the famous example of what was the French painter Gauguin? Was that famous
Gauguin.
Guy who
yeah.
you know, ditched his family to move to Tahiti to paint, right?
Yeah.
And it seems to me that like there's a philosophy that says we should unreservedly be enthusiastic about somebody choosing to do that. It seems like at least, you know, if you're going to do it, maybe that was all things considered the right choice to abandon your family to pursue your art, but you should at least feel kind of bad about it.
I feel like your paintings should be better than that.
Well, no. So I think Nietzsche was writing before Gauguin. The Gauguin case is interesting. So his family was, and his family responsibilities were, at least this is the way the story is told, were getting in the way of him achieving his full realization as a painter. And so he needed to leave them and leave them in bad circumstances because they had no money, they had no means of supporting themselves. And yeah, he goes to Tahiti and does achieve greatness there as a painter. I think the majority of his most famous paintings were painted while he was there. But that's Gauguin, right? That wouldn't be my...
No, but what it might allow for is just like how many shitty versions of Gauguin did that, like without, you know, even if it doesn't require that people do anything as monstrous as murdering or, you know, leaving their family in tatters. A philosophy that doesn't obligate you to do things like not leave your family might be just, this is the whole point of emphasizing the constraints on...
Sure.
On murder, right?
And this is the whole point of conventional morality in general, to stop you from doing these things, and even sexual norms, right?
Yoel.
Mr. Free Love, let's just all
listen,
have sex with everybody.
One ground rule for me appearing on this podcast. We discussed this.
Here's the claim about these guys that I think that I find interesting, that you might view. One interpretation of what they're doing is that they are adopting maybe perhaps a wrong view of Nietzsche, but say a view that says something like, I will build my own values unconstrained by conventional morality. And what that might allow me to do is do whatever I think might, you know, sort of help me achieve my whatever maximum potential as a human being. And that they, at least Brandon, kills somebody for the same reason that a mountain climber would climb Mount Everest, right?
So,
because he can.
So that was his art form.
Right. Yeah. And so what they'd be saying is like, this is going to be just something that I am allowed to do this. I don't have to by any means, but let's do this perfect murder because it is like any other art form. You might be constrained by doing art that doesn't harm anybody, but I don't need to be. And so one reading of what they're doing is on the strictly, like a strictly rational one, where they just, because they just can, they actually do it. And that would be a different reading than the psychopath who sort of instrumentally kills, or even kills for shits and giggles, if they're like a serial killer or a sadist. These guys don't seem to be that.
No, they're doing it to prove a theoretical point. But I don't know what the theoretical point is. If their point is, we were born to be murderers, like Gauguin was born to be a painter, that really, in retrospect anyway, we can say that, yeah, Gauguin was, he had potential for greatness in his painting. If they think that they're like that about being murderers, then maybe the sort of Nietzschean idea allows them to do that. But there's no reason to think that they are the Gauguin of murderers. Certainly not Philip, right? He's definitely not. He's like the my daughter is to painting. He is to murderers. Like, he can't hold himself together.
Like an elephant with a paintbrush.
Like a second. Like, he's terrible at it. And like I said, this is why I think it's interesting that Brandon cracks at certain key moments, is that I don't think he was born to do this either. And I'm not sure if anybody is, except, you know, maybe like Hannibal Lecter or something like that. I don't think that they thought that that was what they were put on this earth to do. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what
about the actual case that inspired the film, where Leopold and Loeb did claim that that was one of the reasons that they killed, right? So are they wrong? Are they lying?
It
might have been, but it seems like a misreading, or just like they're making a philosophical mistake in thinking that this was something that they had positive reason to do.
Mm.
So that might be right. I actually think so. Suppose they were making a philosophical mistake, though. I find it less interesting to say that they misread Nietzsche and were motivated by some wrong idea. Not less interesting. I just don't think that they actually were motivated by that. So I think that for at least in this movie, it's much more simple than that. You have some Brandon who could be read as just a psychopath. Just a straight up psychopath, somebody who's just apparently not at all moved by the suffering of others. And it's not inconsistent that he loses it at times because psychopaths don't want to be.
But what about his need to impress the Jimmy Stewart character? Is that something that's compatible with the psychopath?
I don't think it's incompatible. It's just profoundly narcissistic. I think that, you know, this is the way in which narcissists might work. They want to be recognized. Right. And so, you know, I do not study psychopaths for a living. So I don't know but I actually don't think that there is a good answer, maybe even to what, it's still fairly mysterious as to what might motivate a psychopath to do the bad thing. I think we understand maybe why they're not constrained by certain emotional responses to harm others, but why some of them go out and seek to do the bad thing.
I guess that's the key question. What's the positive motivation? We get that there's not the normal constraints that having empathy would provide, but what makes you want to do that rather than just do crossword puzzles?
Right. Yeah. So obviously I'm not a psychopath expert either, but from what I've read, one of the things that's sort of surprising is that they will often do things that are just like instrumentally just very bad ideas, right? So they act kind of stupidly. They'll, murder somebody for their car and then park the car in front of their house, you know, like doing stuff that's really like asking to get caught.
Right.
So it's not like they're just cold, calculating, self-interested. Like, they do these strange, impulsive things that are very risky.
Really bad at future orientation,
This is the key question. What was their motivation? The motivation of the characters in this movie, of Leopold and Loeb?
Right.
What would make you want to embark on the project of trying to kill somebody?
Well, I mean, I think that it's usually not that mysterious. It's usually purely instrumental, right? I think most violence for a psychopath is like, well, look, like you got in the way of me achieving this local goal.
Right, okay.
And yeah. It may be that I shove you to the side, but if you keep annoying me, I might stab you. In the same way that for you and I, we would never think of that as a solution, but there are all kinds of things that we might do to gain an instrumental.
Okay. So setting that, but
there's a new
category. That's not the case for these two boys. David is not in the way of any goal that, except what? Like, what is their?
Well, so this is why I think these people and Leopold, for instance, inspire horror and fear in us, because that you might have somebody who is, you can kind of understand the stupidity of the psychopath who kills someone because they need their car, and that seems like the best way to steal the car. But for someone to just be okay with motivated to just kill someone for no reason, like for zero reason, that's like, I think the stuff that nightmares are made of. And one question is, if such people exist, what the hell are we to make of them? Like, I don't even think that person, it's not even psychopathy that's making them do it.
I wonder if this is why everybody wants to blame this on Nietzsche, is because we need to blame it on something. Like, we need to find some explanation for why a Leopold and Loeb would kill a schoolmate of them that they had nothing against. I mean, why would they do it? Oh, it's because he read Nietzsche. But I don't think that answers the question, because I don't think that nothing in Nietzsche provides any kind of positive motivation to do what Leopold and Loeb did.
It's just, it makes me think that, like, you know, Leopold or Brad is just like, hey, I'm so random. Like, that's why I did it. I'm just so random. You don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to murder you. I'm going to go.
I just killed someone.
But that's a scary thought that you could just for zero reason be the victim of a murder.
Well.
Right. It's not, you know, it's not even the case that Brandon seems to take pleasure, you know, he's not like a sadist who is, you know, gets off on the murder part. He just could. Like, it's not clear that he wants to keep murdering anybody. It's just all of a sudden he just wants to murder someone.
Do you detect any motivation in Brandon in the movie, Yoel?
None, really. None that makes any sense to me.
Well, what about the, I want to be a great artist, and this is a great work of art. This is a masterpiece. This is my ceiling of the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah,
that I, you know, putting the, inviting the parents over, putting the dead body on the, in the, you know, like in where they're eating. This is a beautiful aesthetic piece of work.
Right. One problem with that is it's frustrating to make something so perfect and then not share it with anybody.
That's their downfall.
I do agree it's, I think we're supposed to think that he wants Jimmy Stewart's character to find out, because otherwise what's the point? Otherwise it's sort of a waste if you haven't shared your achievement with anybody.
You know, maybe this is just from the get-go, we know that this is doomed. As you say, it's their downfall, or at least Brandon's downfall. It's unclear what he might have thought would happen. I mean, there's one way in which maybe he would say, like, well, what's going to happen is Rupert is going to figure it out, and he's going to say, like, you know, give me a
slow clap. Well done, buddy.
For finally for having the fucking guts to have done what he never could, and like having lived up to the philosophy. When in reality, and maybe this is what I want to get to, in reality, Rupert's reaction is just one of horror.
Before we leave this, about the idea of, you know, I want to commit the perfect murder as a work of art. To me, this seems like cartoon supervillain kind of reasoning. You know, where like they'll come up with stuff like, there's so much suffering in the world, it's better to just kill everybody.
It's like antinatalism. Right.
It has like the form of like something that kind of makes sense, but nobody actually thinks that. And that's the same kind of feeling that I get from this. It's like, yeah, well, okay, you said some things that kind of, they have a form of like something, a reasonable justification, but I can't imagine the actual person who would actually truly believe that.
Right. I'm gonna kill you to make copies.
Right. Right.
Well, I mean, but to their credit, so here's one thing that Hitchcock could have done. And in fact, in the British play, it's alluded to and almost stated flat out that the Jimmy Stewart character had an affair with one of the students. And so you could paint this as, you know, like a daddy issue. He's never given me the respect that I feel I'm due. But now he'll know. This will prove to him that I am at his level, that I am his intellectual equal. I can be admitted into this club. Like, it's just this burning quest for approval. I mean, they hint at that a couple times with Brandon, just his need for approval. But I don't think they overplay it. But I think that's probably good. Because I think that it is, this kind of stuff does happen. It has happened. And so, and part of the thing that's, as Dave said, is that the thing that scares us is that we can't understand it. We don't understand. There's no theoretical motivation. There's no psychological one that we can relate to.
I think it would have been, and I actually hate this about villain movies when you are given the clear answer as to what their motivation was. And it ends up that he was abused by a guy who, you know, looked like that guy. And so I think this is maybe an attempt at inspiring this, maybe for lack of a better word, awe at the thought that somebody could just do something horrible and monstrous for no good reason. And I think I would have been much more disappointed had they given us like a neat and tidy story.
Right. The daddy issues.
It's like it's a Iago, right? It's like you never know why Iago sets all those events in motion. And that's the thing that like is the scariest character in all of Shakespeare.
I should read that.
Should learn to read.
I should read.
So let's play that last clip. The Jimmy Stewart speech.
Jimmy Stewart speech. And let's talk about it because I want to know what you guys think about it.
No, this I thought was clearly the worst part of the movie for me. Like, just corny. Just so corny.
We should set it up. This is the speech that Jimmy Stewart gives right after he finds out what they've done.
Rupert, please.
Please what?
Listen to me. Just listen. Let me explain.
Explain? Do you think you're going to explain that?
Yes, to you I can. Because you'll understand.
Understand?
Rupert, what? Rupert, remember the discussion we had before with Mr. Kentley?
Yes.
Remember we said the lives of inferior beings are unimportant? Remember we said, we've always said, you and I, that moral concepts of good and evil and right and wrong don't hold for the intellectually superior. Remember, Rupert? That's all Philip and I have done. He and I have lived what you and I have talked. I knew you'd understand, because you have to, don't you see? You have to.
Brandon, until this very moment, this world and the people in it have always been dark and incomprehensible to me. And I've tried to clear my way with logic and superior intellect. And you've thrown my own words right back in my face, Brandon. You were right, too. If nothing else, a man should stand by his words. But you've given my words a meaning that I never dreamed of. And you've tried to twist them into a cold, logical excuse for your ugly murder. Well, they never were that, Brandon. And you can't make them that. There must have been something deep inside you from the very start that let you do this thing. But there's always been something deep inside me that would never let me do it. And would never let me be a party to it now.
What do you mean?
I mean that tonight you've made me ashamed of every concept I ever had of superior or inferior beings. And I thank you for that shame. Because now I know that we are each of us a separate human being, Brandon. With the right to live and work and think as individuals. But with an obligation to the society we live in. By what right do you dare say that there's a superior few to which you belong? By what right did you dare decide that that boy in there was inferior and therefore could be killed? Did you think you were God, Brandon?
Is that what you thought when you choked the life out of him? Is that what you thought when you served food from his grave? Well, I don't know what you thought or what you are, but I know what you've done. You've murdered! You've strangled the life out of a fellow human being who could live and love as you never could.
Yeah, well, actually, you were leading.
So, and now I've lost my...
You said this was the part of the movie you hated.
Right, that I, did, yeah. that I didn't like because it felt corny. It was full on Jimmy Stewart being Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. so he's like lived this this life of intellectual detachment and making clever jokes about murder. And now he's just going to completely do a 180 and give them a lecture about human dignity. It just felt really jarring.
So there are a couple of reasons that I had to really dislike the speech. And one is it's Jimmy Stewart. I just don't buy it. I didn't buy his character too much from the beginning. And I think another actor could have.
Well, you know, they tried to give it to Cary Grant, but because of the gay subtext, he didn't want to do it because he was getting enough shit about that and all the gossip magazines. But I do think he would have been better.
But you can't blame Jimmy Stewart for not being able to deliver this in a non-Jimmy Stewart way. Then there's what you all just said, which is him doing a 180, which I... But the part that I really just don't buy is that he is accepting that he, in any way, his stupid philosophy is what the cause of the murders was. So he's actually, like, empowering himself as this professor who did really influence somebody through his philosophy that gave rise to this murder, when I actually think it's bullshit. There's if I were even espousing philosophy like this, I would be just like, you're just a psycho because
but that's what he says.
It can't possibly he says be that my though. Philosophy.
I'm surprised that you have this reaction because he says that explicitly. He says there must have been something deep inside of you from the very start that let you do this thing, but there's always been something deep inside me that would never let me do it.
But that's different. So he says he's granting the power of his argument. He's just saying that I had something constraining me from taking my argument to its behavioral conclusion.
No, he didn't say that.
And you never
he says,
had that.
You've tried to twist them, my words, into a cold logical excuse for your ugly murder. He says, well, they never were that, Brandon. You can't make them that.
Except for that, then he says, by what right do you dare say there's a superior few to which you belong? By what right do you dare decide that boy in there was inferior and therefore could be killed? And he's saying that's exactly what he was saying before. So he's not saying I was wrong about the philosophy, and he's not saying my philosophy couldn't have been what's underlying your murder. He's saying, okay, I was saying that there's superior many and an inferior few, but like, what gave you the right to say that you were the superior one and they were the inferior few, when I actually think that he's just was just a psychopath who at best, then maybe he's inconsistent. He's saying my words never meant that, but then he's saying my words were powerful enough. It's just that you chose the wrong superior versus inferior people. Like, you put yourself in the category, but that's not denying that there might be some superior people who could murder some inferior people. It's just that who was Brandon to decide that?
Yeah, no, that I sense? Think tonight you've made me ashamed of every concept I ever had of superior or inferior beings. So it does. It's not just like, oh no, the concept is sound. Is you executed it poorly? It's no, I'm taking it all back. Which it's
I'm taking it back as the 180, but he is saying that, like, but my philosophy did cause that, and that's why I'm taking it back.
Well, yeah, or at least a misinterpretation of my philosophy caused this. This is an interesting question, actually. It's like, do you put out a philosophy that can be misinterpreted in a way that will lead to some sort of horribly immoral act that you never intended, right? This is a question that we as professors face all the time, right? You know, and I think that is a theme in this movie. It's like, we can talk about these things and sort of laugh in our sophisticated way, but, you know, every once in a while you'll get a Brandon who will take them as an excuse to do this horrible thing. So, I mean, I see a coherence to what he's saying. I think what he's saying is, look, if you're not a psycho, my words make sense, but they also might provide an excuse for a psycho to do what otherwise he had no excuse to do. And that's
charitable in the reading. It sounds incoherent to me because he's saying, I never meant that, but shit, I take back that I meant that. Now I don't mean it anymore. Right? And now I'm ashamed of what I said.
Do you think he really doesn't?
Well, he says it.
But no, he says, I'm ashamed of every concept, but he doesn't say it was wrong. He says, I'm ashamed of it.
Well, he says, but he says correctively because now I know that we're each of us separate human beings. So he's correcting his philosophical
right, but with an obligation to the society we live in.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so that's bad.
Exactly. Like, because it would be one thing if he was like, oh my God, you guys completely misinterpreted my philosophy. And I still meant what I said. It's just that you got it wrong. But here he seems to be doing.
If you thought, knowing how easily this can be misinterpreted, I'm not going to say it any longer, right? Like, I still believe it to be true, but I'm really, you know, it's too dangerous to put it out there. But he's like, no, this has caused me to fundamentally reevaluate the rightness of my beliefs. And
he also said that you've twisted my words.
Right. So that you can't have both, right?
You can. Because you could believe there were inferior and superior beings, but not that means the superior beings have a right to kill the inferior beings and murder them in cold blood for no reason.
But that's what he did. But that's explicitly what he was espousing. The earlier scenes where he's saying, like, yeah, I totally think it's okay to.
But he was joking. That was a joke. That was, I think, supposed to be like, here's an obviously dumb conclusion you could draw from my idea that there are naturally superior and naturally inferior beings.
Well, but then again, then if that's really the case, then he's just on firm ground to say, I'd never meant that.
Right.
So
then what he's saying is, but now what I'm retracting isn't this idea that you can kill people if you're a superior. What I'm retracting is the idea that there even is these inferior or superior beings in the first place, because I know that we all are individual human beings with dignity and an obligation to the society we live in. So he's still retracting something, but that's consistent with his original words being misinterpreted.
I guess then, you know, he's
principle of charity.
It doesn't make so much sense though to say, I never meant that and shit. Like,
also, I take it back.
I did mean this one thing that you've made me. Yeah.
I take back what I did say, but what I did say didn't entail that you could kill somebody.
So at best, it's philosophically wussy for taking it back then, right? If you just really say it didn't entail it, like I should never have told you guys this, then there's no reason to take back the argument. But he does take back the argument. He is sort of shocked into changing a philosophy that does not really require to change in any way. And he turns into like a good Kantian all of a sudden.
Well, yeah, now that's bad. And this guy.
This ends with them getting caught, and then there's a fairly not that interesting sort of, you know, scene. Wait,
can we just say one thing, though? I mean, before we leave that scene, I think he's right that there was something deep inside Brandon. And this was Clarence Darrow's point in his defense of Leopold and Loeb trying to get them to not get the death penalty. And, you know, he gave essentially the Galen Strawson, Dirk Paraboom, free will skepticism argument. He just said, look, what bad luck, essentially, to have whatever little quirk within your personality that you would read Nietzsche and this is the conclusion that you would draw. Think of all the people that have read Nietzsche and all the people, you know, like nobody goes out and then tries to commit.
Isn't that trivially true, though? Isn't that just restating the facts? I mean, all I'm saying is it's not a deep insight about Brandon. It's like most people read Nietzsche or hear like arguments about why it's okay to murder your inferiors, and they don't go out and actually kill anybody. And he does, and therefore there must be something distinctive about him.
But the additional point was whatever it was that made Brandon what he is or Leopold and Loeb what they were, is not something that was up to them or, you know, within their control. Yeah, no, it's not a deep point. It's an argument that's been made.
But it's not even a shallow point. It's a it's what you're all saying is it's a tautological one. I mean, what is the alternative of there being something in Brandon that made him kill?
We're getting confused a little bit between the Clarence Darrow arguments at trial and the speech in the movie. Whereas the
Jimmy Stewart's speech
does not sound like he's excusing them on the
not
basis
at all.
Of a critique of free will, right?
That's right. Sorry. It was leaping off that question of there is something deep inside you that would make you do that. And there's not something deep inside me that would allow me to do that, no matter what a teacher had told me or no matter what I theoretically believed.
I guess what's interesting is that, like, you can say that and mean two entirely different things about the extent to which you find the person to be morally responsible.
Right, so
the
way, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Jimmy Stewart seems to be saying exactly the opposite of what Clarence Darrow was saying by stating the same fact.
I think it's you're evil.
You must be evil. That's what I got from that.
Or you're broken, though. I think it could be both. Like, I think I don't think you can get
it
from
this. Jimmy Stewart thinks that they're evil. I think Jimmy Stewart thinks they're evil. I think his attitude of condemnation is clearly, like, you're monsters, right? Is that
does Darrow think that they're, like, because they are. They did this thing. But I think Darrow's point is they're broken. It's not their fault that they're like this. Jimmy Stewart, I think, could be saying they're evil and they made the free choice to be evil, or that they're also just they're malfunctioning human beings.
Well, I don't think that his attitude is consistent with any acceptance of lack of responsibility, right? I mean, you're right that you could use the term moral monster to mean somebody who was determined, but I think it's pretty clear that what Jimmy Stewart is at least trying to express in this at the end is pure condemnation. And I think that in a lay sense, that condemnation is just, you know, he's saying he is not. This would not be something that would be used as a defense speech for closing, you know, the closing.
that I still was curious what you guys thought about was, like, what's the extent to which you're liable for misinterpretation as a philosopher? Right. So, like,
you guys teach some of this stuff too. So,
I was just thinking about, like, in my last class period, teaching the emotion and morality stuff, and I was challenging them to defend why zoophilia was wrong, and thinking that maybe, like, somebody actually might go and actually, like, fuck their dog because they were convinced.
Right.
There was something in you that wanted to fuck your dog.
Right.
You've twisted my words out of their all. Unless I had, like, six beers.
Right.
You did it sober, you monster.
Right, right. So imagine you do the Mark and Julie sibling incest example, and somebody comes back the next week and is like, you know, you really convinced me, Professor. I am going to hook up with my sister.
Right. Right.
No, here's the best. Like, they invite you to a party and with their parents and everything, and they slowly reveal to you that they had sex with their sister, and, like, looking to you to be proud.
Right.
And then you come back and, like, catch them in the act, and you're like, what?
No, and you're being all kind of, like, telling the Julie and Mark story at the party, and everybody comes up with their objections, and you play devil's advocate, and they're all like, yeah, exactly. Like, there's nothing wrong with it. No, I mean, it's a good question, right? I've gotten emails, you know, when I was back in my free will skeptic days, that definitely, I think, showed in my teaching. And I used to get emails from former students saying that this really influenced them, but it was usually in a good way. You know, that they always were really resentful of their father or something like that. And now they've learned to chill out and be more relaxed, and it's been really helpful in their job or something like that. It was never, now that I realized that I wasn't morally responsible, I figured I could just kill that, you know, little puppy, you know, and like, because I don't think that's the normal human response to these kinds of views.
Here's what I wanted to bring up actually earlier when that's related to this. The speech says, there must have been something deep inside of you from the very start. And we've talked about the possibility that this is why at the end, he's not a normal person. And that's why he was able to take these arguments, because at a fundamental level, like this was just a, he's a broken human being or he's evil, like those two options. But really, I think one of the reasons that I realize I don't like this speech is because the much scarier conclusion to me is that there is not anything deep inside of him that made him do this. It's something just very shallow that, in fact, like, just for trivial reasons, he was convinced temporarily by this argument and it made him just like, I'll go do this. Because it's easier to say, oh, like, this person was genetically just broken, or their biology is different from ours, or they chose evil in a way that only a monster right. would. But what if just in the moment he's like, even if he just, if he planned it, but it was nothing deep, that in no other way has he deferred.
Sort of like,
in,
like the Milgram or Stanford Prison Experiment, except that the situation is reading text.
Jimmy Stewart is just that convincing. Yeah, that's what makes this speech so unsatisfying, is like, he's sort of Weasley in two ways that are like logically incompatible. I think it would be a lot ballsier if he were like, I really blame myself because you are a normal kid and I convinced you to murder. That's cool.
Right.
But yeah, both like, yeah, I retract like, my views and...
Your Honor, I should be tried for this.
It's just not plausible to read this like a situationist, because, you know, like the whole point of situationism is you put somebody in this situation and they're more likely than not to act in this way. Whereas for every, you know, 10 million people that read Nietzsche, this happens once...
Yeah, you're right.
No, that's totally true.
But that's why I think that I actually don't mean situationism. I don't mean that it was the pressure of the situation that caused Brandon to act this way. I mean that quite literally he could have formulated a reason in the moment to murder that was unlike any reasons that he's had or motivations that he's had before. He just decides to do it one day. Like he's, you know, he's just like, hey, you know, like, let me try out this murder thing just this once. And so it's not that there was a pressure of the situation or the undue influence of the professor, but rather he actually internally generated a motivation and a reason to act in a morally monstrous way. He never does it again. Like the Mark and Julie story, they decide never to do it again. That's part of what's so weird about that story is that just one day they decided to fuck and then like they never do it again. And because you want to have some story about how like he was always motivated to be violent, or, you know, he was sort of broken, or he was, you know, boys from Brazil sort of conditioned or pressured somehow. But no, what if just today I'll buy a Charleston Chew. I haven't had one of those in a while. And then later on, I'll strangle a child because I haven't done that either.
I guess it doesn't seem psychologically plausible to me because of how much planning and deliberation the whole thing took. What worries me, because I'm always like biking to school, is if somebody just on a whim just decides, you know what, fuck this guy. I think I read this in a novel, and just decides to like sideswipe into me to kill me, like while they're driving, you know. But to go through the planning of the murder and then the planning of the party and all of that, it just doesn't seem like it could be that much of a whim.
Sorry. And I don't mean whim then either. Like, I mean a reason, and perhaps even a deliberation for some time, like the Mark and Julie story where like they weren't caught up in lust. They just decided one day to do it. And so, and I think that's what's scary about Leopold, is like he decided just to do this, and maybe it took a week of planning, and but he'd never done it before. There's no indication of like I don't know about Leopold specifically, but the possibility that there might be no indication beforehand that somebody is capable of this or that they want to do this, and then one day they just have instantiate this desire and the motivation and the reason to do it, and then they just go back to being
normal. And that sets it all in motion.
Just because they could.
Right.
That would be super scary because we can't pinpoint a cause.
In the end, the idea that like, well, some people are monsters. I mean, in a way that's scary because, well, you might not know. Maybe it's not obvious, but you have some chance of finding out, right? Whereas it's much scarier to think like, well, anybody could just like on a whim be like, hey, you know what, murder. I mean, I don't believe that's true, but that would be frightening.
It's hard to know, you know, like some of these school shootings, you know, or these we want to spin a story, and that we want a story that will allow us to preemptively distinguish the people who are likely to commit murder. But it's also very possible that in some cases, somebody has a temporary desire instantiated in them to commit murder. And that, you know, it may be implausible and untrue.
You know, it's funny. I've never thought about Julian Mark and just that line where one day they decided that it would be fun. Like, who decides it would be fun to have sex? That's not how it works, right? It's not an intellectual decision.
You and me. Right. Why are we doing this?
There's a researcher at the University of Pennsylvania, Ed Roisman. David, you probably know him.
Great work. Yeah, I love his work.
He's a brilliant guy and just a super interesting character. And he objects to this scenario partly on the basis of he thinks people aren't really buying the premise, that they're sort of going along with the premise in order to be nice or because of conversational norms, but that there's stuff about the premise that they really don't believe. And one of the things he says that they're very skeptical about is that they decide to never do it again. So it just seems implausible that you would just decide to do this once and never again.
Once you go in,
exactly, you don't go back. The sweetest meat.
But what I've never questioned is that, and I don't know why, because now just after Dave was saying that about murder, it's like, which also doesn't seem psychologically plausible to me. Just the decision that it would be fun to have sex. I can't relate to that. Like, I've never decided it would be fun to have sex with somebody, sort of mutually agreed upon sex, and then we just start having sex. Like,
you have non-consensual sex. You only have
consensual, obviously, but it's like, it's not reasoned out. It's not
right. Yeah, one day they decided it's not like going to the beach, like on the first day of spring or something. You know,
what should we do today? Should we go to the movies should we maybe fuck? I don't know.
Let's strangle a chicken.
That's a lie. I never strangled a chicken in my life.
My chicken feels pretty strangled right now. Actually, it's all this incest talk.
That's a lie. I never strangled a chicken in my life.
Maybe we should just say they get caught. There's a struggle. There's a gun.
The gun thing is also totally ridiculous.
Yeah. It's not the strong point of the movie.
Can we just talk about the Philip character? The choice to just make him slowly descend into just being a total mess. Is that a choice that has some sort of importance or what?
You mean just to get sloppy and lose?
Well, he's
shit?
Just slowly. It is a sort of progression. Like, at first, he's just a little nervous. Then there's that scene where he's playing the piano, except that he's clearly not playing the piano. The keys are barely going down. And there's also a scene. Eliza noticed this. This is probably the one take thing where he cuts his hand.
Yeah.
Like, 2 minutes later, his hand is completely healed. There's no blood. There's no bandage. There's no nothing.
Yeah, to make a continuity error in a continuous shot.
Right. So, yeah. But then just to get him to a point where he's just drunk and sloppy, like, why?
I take it that this was supposed to be some attempt to show that it was actually Brandon who was the driving force, and that the only reason Philip was doing it was Philip here is kind of the victim. I mean, he's obviously love struck and has guilt immediately.
But there's not something deep inside Philip, maybe that's.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's. Except for Brandon. Yeah.
I wonder if that was even a reference.
Think deep inside that's, of you.
And then there's obviously, like, you know, just plot reasons. That he needs to get nervous and give stuff away. If they're both too calm and collected, then they don't get discovered. Right.
It's tension adding. Like, how can you let that rope show? Like, how can you possibly actually see
You know, it's funny. I'm liking this movie less. As opposed to the other movies, and Unforgiven being the prime example, where I like it more, breaking it down. Like, I'm liking this movie a lot less than I liked it while I was watching it, which was a lot, you know? But I think probably that's because so much of its quality is based in how, in the shooting of it.
Right, the visual style and the feeling, and, like the feeling of tension.
Yeah, it's a great yeah. tension builder in the truest Hitchcock sense. But it does rely on this particular just point about somebody kind of non-instrumentally committing this huge act of violence and justifying it. But that's in order to tell that story right, you kind of have to convince us that that could happen. And maybe the failure is in never believing that what we're supposed to believe happened, which is Jimmy Stewart's philosophy really somehow got to Brandon. That never really is convincing. And Jimmy Stewart's claim later on that there must be something deeply inside Brandon that's wrong with him is also never fully developed.
And the sort of hints at he's doing this for approval also isn't fully developed. But again, we were saying this could be a strength, right? Like the scariest thing is when you don't have a good explanation.
Right. And that's why I think that the speech at the end kind of takes away from it, because what he should react, the proper reaction is like, holy shit, somebody could do this. Like not sort of your moral monster. There's something so deeply wrong with you, but almost silence at, I don't know how you could end it trying to communicate that.
I wonder if that was not their choice, like not an artistic choice, but a producer stepping in and saying, look,
yeah,
we need
maybe, or maybe a code thing, because it's sort of threatening in a few ways of how can a person who seems otherwise normal decide to do this? And is it really that this philosophy, which is, espoused by this like smart, charming guy, like, could it really be interpreted to mean that this is okay? And then they just step in at the end and they're like, okay, let me just explain. This guy was evil and these beliefs are wrong. Just so we're all on the same page. End of movie.
Right.
I don't think it's a code thing, though, because there were plenty of bleak message movies out at that time. Like, the code was pretty focused on sex. Think of The Third Man. There's no affirming of positive values in that movie.
Well, although the bad guy gets his in the end.
They could still get theirs without Jimmy Stewart, like, all of a sudden becoming, like, a champion of of Western
human rights.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obligations to society.
I used to not believe in Jesus, but now I have to.
Yeah.
We all like women.
We all like women. I'm surprised they just didn't blame it on like the gay part.
Right. Well, that would have had had to acknowledge that people are gay, which that's out of bounds.
That's right. Nothing to see here.
You know, married people couldn't be in the same bed, and if like they couldn't share the same bed, if they. Yeah. We're even just on the same bed. One of them had to have like their foot on the floor or something.
Yeah, no, I remember this from Ricky and Lucy episode. They at the beginning they used to have separate.
But what
beds.
What like, morality is it that doesn't allow husbands and wives to have sex? I'm not familiar with that morality.
Because presumably kids would see their own parents sharing one bed, so it's not
right. It's not going to blow their minds.
Let's wrap this up.
All right. Well, okay. I think this movie is very worth seeing. That's all I wanted to say by that, is that I do think this movie is worth seeing, and I hope people will see it.
Yep.
We've been critical, but it's. I agree. I'm glad that I watched it. And it's just a lot of fun to watch. It's just so well made.
And the other thing I would say is somebody posted on our Facebook page that we should do an episode on nihilism. I think between this episode and I think it was episode 10 about the meaning of life, between that, this episode, and maybe episode 3, you have your nihilism episodes.
Next time we'll do the Big Lebowski then.
Could we do a whole podcast about the Big Lebowski?
There's nothing. There's not that movie's nothing. It's a great movie, but it's not. It's about nothing. I don't know.
I'm less convinced. I think maybe we could.
Yeah, I know. So is Tablet.
I think we could tie it with like human virtue and flourishing.
Yes.
All right. Till the next movie episode.
All right. Thanks, guys. I think it's been fun.
You bought yourself another movie episode. Good job.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Pay no attention to that. man. They think deep thoughts, and with no more brains than you have.
Pay no attention to that man.
Anybody can have a brain.
You're a very bad man.
I'm a very good man. Just a very bad wizard.